Hi there, Jeb Sharp here with How We Got Here, the history podcast from PRI's The World. Remember Darfur? On today's podcast, Marco Werman speaks with Rebecca Hamilton, author of Fighting for Darfur, Public Action and the Struggle to Stop Genocide.
I think we, and I have to include myself in the start of this, were over-reliant on the analysis that we had been given of what had gone wrong in Rwanda, the genocide there in 1994. People who did the lessons learned writing from that came out with the conclusion that what was missing was an outcry from the American people. And it was a very, you know, post-Cold War analysis. If the American people just raise hell, then the U.S. government will do something, and then this situation can be resolved. That was not the geopolitical reality at the start of the 21st century. So we had kind of overlearnt the lessons of the last war, as it were.
More from Rebecca Hamilton in a moment. First, I need to remind you that How We Got Here comes to you via PRI's The World. The World is a public radio program about all things global. It's co-produced by the BBC World Service, Public Radio International, and WGBH in Boston. I haven't forgotten Egypt. Still collecting your questions. We'll have more on the uprising there soon. But I didn't want to miss the opportunity to offer you Marco's interview with Rebecca Hamilton about the history of the Darfur movement so far and what it has accomplished, especially since Sudan is right next door to Egypt and not unaffected by the mood there. So here's Marco, and a shorter version of this interview ran on The World on February 4th, 2011, the day it was recorded.
Rebecca Hamilton is author of the new book, Fighting for Darfur, Public Action and the Struggle to Stop Genocide. She's just back from a reporting trip to Sudan and joins me in our studios in Boston. Thanks for being here. I mean, the big news out of this part of the world is Egypt this week, but it's interesting how much is actually going on in Sudan today. We'll talk more directly to Sudan in a moment, but for you, Rebecca, with Sudan right next door to Egypt, what are the implications for Sudan of Egypt, but also, you know, the other uprisings in the region?
I think it's got to be making the ruling regime in Sudan very nervous because they know that in many quarters they don't have the popular support of the people. There were supposedly democratic elections last year, but they were neither free nor fair. And there are many in the north of the country who don't want to see this regime stay in power.
I mean, it's a delicate time for Sudan. The country is about to split in two after Southerners voted overwhelmingly last month for independence. Before the referendum, there were great fears of a return to civil war. What do you think the prospects are now?
I think the referendum went off incredibly well, successfully, peacefully, and there's no doubt that Southerners have voted for independence. The question is not only the viability of a new southern state, which is starting from a position where there's a population that's 85% illiterate, where there are only 40 miles of paved roads in the entirety of the country, but also what is the viability of the new northern state? And at the moment, the northern economy is in a terrible situation. It's about to lose some significant share of the oil revenues when the south splits. And how long can it sustain this population if the economy goes south?
Now, Rebecca, your new book is about Darfur and specifically the U.S. advocacy movement to stop genocide there. Before we get to that movement, what's happening in Darfur today?
The situation in Darfur today is bleak. In essence, all of the causes that led to the massacres that we saw in 2003 and 2004 that captured global attention, all those factors are still in play. The people who perpetrated those massacres are still in power. There has been no accountability. There has been no compensation. There are 2.7 million people who are still in displaced camps who can't return to the land that they were forced to flee from. And whilst the international attention has been on the south, you've seen the government ramping up again its military campaign in Darfur.
Are there people dying? Are people getting killed?
Yes, people are dying. More than mass deaths, you're seeing mass displacement because people are scared. They don't feel secure. And the situation has become so much more complex than if we had got involved properly early on, because now, in addition to what are seen as the victim groups, the non-Arab groups in Darfur, the Arab groups themselves that were manipulated by the government to conduct some of these atrocities back in 2003, 2004, also feel like they're disenfranchised, they're turning against each other and against the government.
Well, that leads us directly to your book and what it's about. You've done some incredibly extensive reporting and also some soul-searching about what activists were able to achieve. You were yourself an activist for Darfur in the beginning. the movement on the surface seems to be a force for good, the movement to get around this genocide in Darfur from the United States. But how much did it complicate the reaction to the genocide, do you think?
Yes, great question. Hugely complicated, the policy response, for a few reasons. Firstly, there are dynamics that come with a mass outcry. They demand strong rhetoric from whoever they're targeting, which was in this case the U.S. government, and they push them to come out with rhetoric that consistently said Darfur is a genocide, very strong language. That could have been useful if they had the policy options to back that up. But the U.S. government was in many ways the worst placed government at this particular period in history.
And
geopolitically speaking, after the invasion of Iraq, Afghanistan, U.S. credibility was at an all-time low to be the one that was speaking out on human rights abuses. And so I think the theory of the movement had been coming out of a kind of 20th century analysis. If the U.S. gets out there in front and speaks on human rights, then the world will follow. In actual fact, the reverse happened when the U.S. got out in front and started talking about Darfur. It completely turned off the rest of the world from engaging in the issue.
Not to mention incredibly intense congressional focus on South Sudan at the expense of what was happening in Darfur.
You know, I think that the South Sudan advocates in Congress did a good job of being able to integrate Darfur into everything that they were pushing for. So I'm less concerned about that. But I do think that more recently we've seen the U.S. government shift to just deploying all resources to making sure that the southern referendum goes ahead and Darfur has been lost in that mix.
Where do you think the Darfur activists in the States got it wrong and perhaps made things worse?
I think we, and I have to include myself in the start of this, were over-reliant on the analysis that we had been given of what had gone wrong in Rwanda, the genocide there in 1994. People who did the lessons learned writing from that came out with the conclusion that what was missing was an outcry from the American people. And it was a very, you know, post-Cold War analysis. If the American people just raise hell, then the U.S. government will do something and then this situation can be resolved. That was not the geopolitical reality at the start of the 21st century. So we had kind of overlearned the lessons of the last war, as it were.
Now, what about the pressure on the Pentagon to do something? You already spoke about the wars that were going on at the time. Obviously, there were some personnel that were not available to do anything. But should the Pentagon have done something? I mean, morally, where were they situated to answer that?
You know, by the time that the advocacy outcry really happened, and that was actually, in fact, after most of the deaths from direct violence in Darfur occurred, I don't think that the right solution would have been for the Pentagon to go in there. You had a situation of, by that time, fragmented militias, fragmented rebel groups, and had you had the U.S. forcefully intervening, Khartoum would have made this rallying call that it's another U.S. invasion in a third Muslim country and a cry for jihadists globally to come in. So I don't think it would have been the right policy option anyway. Where it does become a problem is that even the credible threat of U.S. intervention was taken off the table by Iraq and Afghanistan. And having had that as a credible threat in hand could have really increased U.S. leverage to change Khartoum's behavior.
What about you, Rebecca? I mean, you started off with the divestment movement at Harvard, a divestment from Sudan. You were at the heart of this movement to stop mass killings in Darfur. Where does this all leave you personally with the subject after all this research into the genocide there? Are you still an activist in the same way, do you think?
No, I mean, I had to stop being an activist in order to conduct this research. So I had to make a sort of conscious break. And of course, I'm still very committed to the overall project of creating a world where we can stop these mass atrocities occurring. But for me, I think compared to where I was maybe 6 or 7 years ago, a much greater appreciation for all the other missing pieces that there are in the genocide prevention puzzle. I think we had assumed, because we had not seen an outcry from the public before in one of these situations, there was a sort of a comfort that we could take in thinking if only there was an outcry, then that would be what it would take to solve this kind of situation. What we've learned from Darfur is even with an outcry, that's not enough. An outcry is a necessary but not sufficient piece of the genocide prevention puzzle.
What do you think the U.S. government, specifically, you know, the White House, has learned from all of this? I mean, if another Darfur starts to happen, I mean, how will the White House react now based on what we've learned from Darfur?
I think arguably one of the benefits of the Darfur movement and the difficulties that we've found is that it's done something of a reevaluation within the system about all the other missing policy pieces that we don't have to deal with a future situation. And one of the things that's been made clear is that there are changes that need to be made internally within the U.S. bureaucracy to ensure that there's coordinated decision-making when one of these crises arise. So there's some movement towards addressing what I'd call the architectural issues that need to be changed to deal with these situations better in the future. But it's just hard to sustain momentum to do bureaucratic change instead of the kind of the easy thing to captivate the public is a crisis with an immediate human face.
Bottom line, do you think it was in the power of the United States to stop the killing in Darfur?
Not alone. I think if the U.S. government really felt like it was a priority that topped traditional national interests, it could have really pushed countries that had more leverage over Khartoum, in particular China, to really influence Khartoum's behavior. But as much as there was a will to do something to change the situation in Darfur, it was never the kind of will that could have topped U.S. government interests in terms of its relationship with China, that it was also trying to deal with, say, North Korea or currency revaluation, things that are more seen in the traditional national interest.
I mean, that's kind of a discouraging answer considering everything else that was going on at the time. It almost sounds like you're saying there was no way that these people in Darfur were not going to die.
No, I don't think that there is no way. I think that the U.S. government alone couldn't do it. And the trouble was that the advocacy movement was so committed to the belief that if the U.S. government just wanted to badly enough, then it could.
Do you think that there are different types of genocides that demand, perhaps not different, but more nuanced reactions?
Yes, and I think this is a real issue when we start using the label genocide.
Which was a huge issue in the whole Darfur campaign.
Right. And again, this is the hangover of the lessons from Rwanda. In Rwanda, the Clinton administration didn't use the word genocide, and it didn't use the word genocide because it feared that if it did use the word, then the U.S. government would have to do something. The lesson that advocates took from that was that if the U.S. government would call it genocide, it would therefore mean that it was doing something. In a sense, calling it genocide became a policy response. Instead, all it is a word, and it's a word that locks the policy process into a set of options that are constraining. When we think of genocide, we don't think about trying to get the perpetrators to the negotiating table to negotiate a peace agreement, when that's exactly what was needed in Darfur. We tend to think of genocide as something that cannot be stopped without boots on the ground forcibly intervening. And the truth is that the kinds of acts that we see in genocide, the mass killing of civilians of a particular group, can be undertaken to reach an end goal. And if the perpetrators can be convinced that that end goal, say, destroying a insurgency, can be met some other way, then it's possible they can be convinced to pursue another route.
So today, trouble still in Darfur, in the north, in Egypt, crisis, secession likely in the south of Sudan. That must build up a lot of pressure on President al-Bashir, and there's still that arrest warrant for the president. Where does this leave him? What's he going to do now?
I think at the moment he's being promised an awful lot by the U.S. government to let southern secession continue. And, you know, the U.S. government is going to have to deliver on those promises. But that cannot wipe the slate clean for the ongoing human rights abuses in the north. And I think it's going to be a very tricky line for the U.S. government to walk how to balance those things. I think right now Bashir and the entire regime around him feels more vulnerable than they have in years, mostly because because of the economic conditions that change once the South secedes. For a long time, they've been able to insulate themselves from massive U.S. sanctions economically, diplomatically, because of the oil revenues that they've had. And all those dynamics are now about to change.
And typically, how does Omar al-Bashir kind of behave when he feels such pressure and so vulnerable?
Yeah, it's not a good situation for the people in the north because the typical reaction is anger, it's unpredictable, and it's a crackdown with the deployment of the internal security services. And that's exactly what we've seen on the protesters that have started in the north of Sudan. There's been brutal attempts to quash their protests, arrests of opposition activists. There are still journalists and activists who are being detained incommunicado right now. So very, very troubling.
Rebecca Hamilton, author of Fighting for Darfur, Public Action and the Struggle to Stop Genocide. Thanks for coming in and speaking with us.
Thank you.
That's it for this episode of How We Got Here. Send your thoughts about Rebecca's analysis of the Darfur movement. You can post them on the How We Got Here page at theworld.org/history, or you can post comments on the How We Got Here Facebook page, or send an email to howwegothere@gmail.com. Or finally, you can tweet me at Jeb Sharp. That's one word, J-E-B-S-H-A-R-P. Thanks for listening and spreading the word about How We Got Here. I couldn't do it without you. I'll speak to you soon.